Hello and welcome to Doctor Dialogues, a podcast for doctors on all things GP. My name is Dr. Simon Hay. I'm a practicing GP and the Deputy Director of Medical Education at GPEX, and I'll also be your host of this podcast. In this podcast, I'll be bringing you insightful dialogues with GPs across the state covering their GP journeys, exam hints and tips, how to manage mental health and more. If there are any topics, questions or even dream guests that you wish for us to cover, we would love to hear from you. Send these through to admin@gpex.com.au and I look forward to hearing from all of you. Thanks and I hope you enjoy the podcast. In this next podcast, I'll be interviewing Associate Professor Jill Benson, who's recently had an article published regarding an approach to mental health. This is called Mental Health in a Nutshell and gives a simple framework to help patients who are suffering from mental health issues. During the podcast, we do mention a few areas where members can access information regarding that article, and we'll make sure we post that resource on the notes section. Hi, this is Simon Hay from GPEX. I'm the Deputy Director of Training here. I'm here with Associate Professor Jill Benson, who works with us at GPEX in a number of areas and has a number of hats that she puts on through her work. One of the expertise areas is in mental health. Now, mental health is often a difficult area, particularly for new GPs coming into GP training, and they're often looking for a tool or a framework that will help them with that. Jill, I understand you've got a tool that you can help GPs of all stages to make mental health less scary and easier to deal with.
Sure. So let me tell you a bit about my mental health background as well.
Sounds good.
So I've worked in mental health like GPs have I've been a GP for over 35 years, but for probably the last 30 years, I've done a lot of mental health. I've got a fellowship at the Australian College of Psychological Medicine. I've written a book on mental health called Mental Health Across Cultures, A Practical Guide for Health Professionals. And I've been a World Health Organization consultant in mental health in Vanuatu, where I helped the country set up mental health in the whole of the country. But these days, I work with refugees, with Aboriginal people, with doctors, and with regular patients.
Yep.
And I put together this tool from all of that background and experience. I am currently the secretary of the WONCA, the World Organisation of GPs Mental Health Working Party. And with some of the other doctors here at GPEX and with some other people on the working party, have written an article about what I'm going to talk to you about, that's just been published. It's called Mental Health in a Nutshell, and it's published in the Mental Health in Family Medicine Journal.
Right,
so that should be out in the next week or so.
Okay, right.
So the reason I put this together was that I was sitting in with a registrar, like you do as a medical educator, and he was a fantastic registrar. He did some cognitive behavioural therapy with a patient with some anxiety disorder and depression problems. And at the end of it, she said to him, "So, that's all good, but what do I do, doctor?" And he looked at her and said, "Be strong." And I thought, no, that's not a doey thing. That's not something to do.
Yeah.
So at the end of it, I went through my I've called Mental Health in a Nutshell tool and just wrote it on a little square of paper and gave it to him. And he looked at me in a slightly accusatory way and he said, "Why haven't you told me this before?" And I said, "Well, you know, it's something that I've been doing for a long time, but it's not written down anywhere." And he said, "Well, you need to write this. You need to tell other people." So that's why I wrote it, and that's why I'm telling people, and that's why I'm telling you now.
And I know you've done that with our registrars at GPEX over the last few years in our orientation sessions.
Yeah, and they've really liked it because it's such a thing to do. Yeah. And we're GPs, we're practical, we like practical things.
Mm.
So this doesn't replace the things that you would normally do if you're doing a mental health consultation. It doesn't replace the DAS-21, it doesn't replace the K-10, doesn't replace cognitive behavioural therapy. It certainly doesn't replace a proper risk assessment.
Yeah.
So if you've got someone with mental health issues, you need to do the things that you would normally do, because that's your diagnostic tools and your psychotherapeutic tools. And of course, you always need to take a proper social history, a medication history. You need to make sure that the person in front of you doesn't have severe anemia, all of those sorts of things. And you particularly need to make sure that they're safe. So this doesn't replace any of those things. But one of the reasons I put it together is that the thing, one of the scary things that happens with mental health problems is that people can cascade down. So
yes.
They become more disabled. I know we usually use the word disabled for physical health, but there's a severe disability that goes with mental health. And we know that depression is one of the top mental top illnesses that decreases a person's ability to function in life.
Yeah.
It's one of the most common. Its disability adjusted life years level is really high. It has a mortality associated with it. But it's about the way it really makes a mess of people's lives, makes a mess of their education, their relationships, their ability to look after themselves, their general health, all of those things. So I call that disability.
I would agree with that as a GP. That's something I see on a regular basis, the effect that mental health problems has on the ability for a person to live their everyday life. So,
Yeah. And so assessing somebody's mental health, you need to assess all of that as well.
Yeah.
And you can sometimes tell the severity of the illness, but more importantly, you can tell the severity of the effect of the illness on a person's life by looking at that disability.
Yeah.
So what mental health in a nutshell does is focus on that.
Right.
So
okay.
It's not a psychotherapy.
Yeah.
It helps an assessment of the way that the mental health problem has affected the person's life, so the disability associated with it, and then it works on that, because we know that if a person is less disabled, if they're functioning better, their mental health's going to get better.
Okay.
So the other thing about this is that we're time poor.
Yes, I would agree with that.
So if you've got a 15-minute consultation, sometimes the mental health bit doesn't come out at the beginning. Sometimes it comes out at the end. So you have to do something really quickly or your whole day is going to fall apart. So that's the other beautiful things about this, is that it can be quick. You don't have to do it all at once. You can just do a little bit of it. But it gives you something to do. It gives the patient something to do. It gives you a hook to get them back. You have to make sure they're safe, of course.
Yeah.
You have to make sure that you don't have to assess them for some physical illness that might be causing their symptoms. But then you can give them something to do.
Okay.
So you can do a mental health plan. You can do all of this. I'm just running through some slides. So let me tell you what this thing is. So I've called it mental health in a nutshell because it's little. It's just a little snapshot of the person, and it gives you an ability easily to work with them.
Yeah.
So you look at their exercise. How much are they doing? Are they just sitting all day playing video games, watching television, not doing anything at all?
Right.
We know that exercise is good for you. We know that it's good for you physically, but we also know it's good for your mental health. And there's a lot of evidence for that. Now, the evidence says that you probably need to do half an hour a day. But if you're really depressed or really anxious, you're not going to be interested in doing half an hour a day, because you're setting yourself up to fail if you say you're going to do it. Finding out what the person's doing. So you're not doing any exercise at all. You're getting your groceries brought in. You're not visiting anybody. You're just doing video games. Yes. Could you walk to the letterbox? Yeah, I could walk to the letterbox. I do that. Could you walk to the corner? The corner. Yeah, I guess I could walk to the corner. How often could you do that? Could you do that every day? Meh. Every second day I could walk to the corner. Now, when the person sets their parameter at that level, most people are going to go, yeah, what's she talking about? I can walk further than the corner. I can do the block.
Yeah.
So they're more likely to exceed your expectations.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, if they don't meet your expectations when they come back, you can say, so, you got to the letterbox, but you didn't quite get to the corner. Let's look at the barriers to that. It was a dog. Could you walk the other direction? So you work with the barriers. But getting them started on that exercise pathway is a really good thing.
It seems like that's enabling them and trying to help work with them and not overwhelm them from that point of view.
And it's giving them a success experience as well, which has got to be good for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So the second thing is social. And we know that people with mental health problems close themselves up. They stop talking to people. They don't go out. They don't do the things that they sometimes know is going to help them. But they don't want to make everybody else miserable, and they don't enjoy it as much as they normally would. But again, there's lots of good evidence that says that relating to somebody is good for you. It's good for your mental health. One of the difficulties with depression and anxiety is they tend to be very introspective sort of things. And, you know, partly people are right. You don't want to go out with your friends, and they don't want to hear your misery guts story. You know that, so you don't go out with your friends.
Yep.
Or your friends don't want to see you anymore because you're just a misery guts. So you have to teach somebody just to talk about the weather, to ask the other person about themselves, to do that more relationship type stuff, that give and take stuff.
Mm.
And so you don't do the worry talk.
Yeah.
So I ban worry talk when they're doing this exercise.
Okay.
So I might say, "You haven't seen anybody at all for 3 weeks, have you? No, just you, doctor. Could you have a coffee with one of your friends? Oh, but I'm such a misery guts." No misery guts stuff. They ask how you are, you lie. You say, "I'm fine, thanks. How are you?" And you listen to their story.
Yeah.
You let them tell you about their sick dog. You let them tell you about their new job. You let them tell you about the annoying mother-in-law. You don't tell them about your stuff. Now, you might at the end say, "It's been so lovely to see you. I was feeling down before I came to see you, but now I feel so much better." So you might say that.
Yeah.
Don't tell them the story, the whole story. Save that for me, save that for other people. So gradually you're putting pennies in the relationship bank as well, because the next time you might be able to tell them a little bit.
Yeah. And what's the feedback that you get from your patients when you give them that advice or that course of action? Do you find that they feel a benefit from just meeting up with their friends and getting some positive interaction?
Of course. But it's hard for them to do because they feel like they have to be themselves and their friends are there for them.
Yeah.
And so you have to have quite a discussion about the two-way
conversation
that needs to happen. Mm. And I say, I want you to act. Mm. I don't want you to tell them exactly how you feel. Mm. But even that acting, we know if you're retraining your brain to have some positive things happening in it. If you're just rehearsing the negative things all the time, that's what your brain's going to be for.
Mm.
That's what you're going to teach your brain. So doing the positive stuff is good.
Yeah.
But I think that not doing the worry talk is one of the hardest things for people to
absolutely.
Do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So the third thing is activities of daily living. And we know that when people are depressed or anxious or, you know, got post-traumatic stress disorder or whatever it is they've got, they don't tend to do the things that they would normally do. So this is about nutrition, it's about sleep, it's about those sorts of things. But it's also about paying your bills, opening your emails, washing up the dishes in the sink. And again, you can cascade down because people go, "Oh no, I haven't opened my emails for a week. I can't face them." Or, "I know that pile is a pile of bills and I can't face them." And they call themselves names. They tell themselves they're stupid, lazy, ridiculous, a dropkick. That's not good for you.
Yeah.
So if you put makeup on, do your hair, iron your shirt, put matching socks on, clean your teeth, do all of those things, you're going to feel physically better.
Yeah.
If you pay one bill a day, if you wash up your dishes, if you do put your garbage out, do some of those things, you're going to feel better about your environment, about yourself.
Mm.
And again, you can start moving the person upwards rather than downwards.
Yeah.
So they're important things to do. It's surprising the things that people say. So I work in a doctor's health clinic. One of the doctors I saw, who was very nicely presented, was giving him this talk, and I said, so normalizing this as part of mental health is a good thing. So I said, sometimes people feel so bad, they don't do their hair. So he had hair like you, so that wasn't a thing. They don't do their hair, they don't clean their teeth, they don't pay their bills. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, I haven't cleaned my teeth for 3 days. It's like, what? It was just like, whoa. It would really open my eyes that he was actually much more depressed than I'd given him credit for.
Yeah.
To not clean your teeth for 3 days, you've got to feel pretty,
pretty down
bad
to do that, yeah.
Yeah. So it can just give you a little insight into the person as
well.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So the next thing is meaning. And this feels like a big thing, meaning. Do you have meaning in your life? People with anxiety and depression aren't going to say, yeah, I have a deep sense of meaning in my life, because they've lost their meaning.
Yeah.
That sense of worthlessness and hopelessness is one of the things that goes with depression.
Mm.
And it's hard to find that inside yourself when you're depressed and anxious.
Mm.
But meaning is about finding some reason for living that's outside yourself, that's not just about yourself.
Yeah.
Now, that might be a spiritual thing.
Mm.
But it might be watering a plant. I'm not going to let that plant die.
Mm.
So one of my patients, we had this discussion. Her daughter was in the room. When she came back, the next time she said, so you know what my daughter's done? And I said, what? She said, she bought me chickens. And I said, great. She said, yeah, it's because of you. It's because of that conversation.
Yeah.
Now, she was just joking.
Yeah,
she was annoyed at me. I said, so what have the chickens done? She said, well, I can't let them die, can I? I've actually got to go outside. I've got to feed them. She said, I actually talk to them. So she was not going to let the chickens die. She had some reason to stay alive because she didn't want the chickens to die. Now, it might be doing something for someone else. It might be taking the garbage bin out for the old lady next door. We're not talking about big meaning here.
Yeah.
We're not talking about changing the world. Small, small things. And again, when somebody's really depressed and anxious, we start small.
Mm. It's amazing the amount of times a pet or an animal can give meaning to life. And I've certainly had that with a number of patients who have used that pet to help maintain their mood to a degree.
Yeah. And they've done research in nursing homes where, you know, often people just feel like it's God's waiting room.
Yeah.
And they've given them a plant to look after.
Okay.
Just a plant.
Yeah.
And it's changed how people view themselves and their world just from keeping a plant alive.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, pets are big responsibility.
Yes. Plants are smaller responsibility, but still.
Yeah. So the next thing is mindfulness. Now, there's lots of research on mindfulness. So mindfulness, most of that research is on what I call proper mindfulness. Which means sitting still for 10 minutes a day, something I'm not good at, so I don't expect my patients to be good at that. But the thing that I've used, having worked with people who have severe post-traumatic stress disorder, is distraction. And distraction is a form of mindfulness. It's taking your mind off the things that are going round and round and round and round in your head. So for me, I knit. I knit really complicated things. For anyone who knits, you know, you've got to concentrate if you're doing something complicated because you make a mistake. And it's like, no, I made a mistake 10 rows back. And that's really annoying. So you've got to concentrate. So you can't worry and knit something complicated at the same time. You have to concentrate. But most people aren't into knitting. There are going to be other things that will distract them.
Yeah.
So one particular patient had severe post-traumatic stress disorder that meant that he could hardly sit through a consultation with me. I said to him, is there any time, at any time, where you don't have all these worries and thoughts and flashbacks in your head? And he said, yes, there's a park near my house and there's a tree. And I go to the tree and I touch the tree and I smell the tree. And I listen to the tree and I feel how rough it is and I can hear the birds in the tree, and just for that moment my brain is still. Now it was just beautiful. It was beautiful. Now this wasn't even a minute, but it was a period of time when his brain wasn't worrying. So what our job then was to increase the amount of time he spent with this tree. So we found a picture of a tree that he had at home that was the same tree. We actually found a photo on Google Earth of the park and we printed that out.
Yeah.
So he carried that around in his wallet And he was, if he was feeling particularly distressed, he could take out the photo and he could remind himself of the tree and the smell and the touch and the sound of his tree. So having that conversation with people about a time when their brain is distracted from all of those worries and depressed thoughts can just move them into a place of mindfulness.
Yeah.
Now you can do the proper mindfulness, you can get apps and do all of that, and they're fantastic, and that's where the evidence sits. But small mindfulness is, again, a place to start. So the next thing is the positive psychology stuff that Martin Seligman talks about. And that's about gratitude in particular. So we know that we are primed in our DNA to look for danger, to look for things to be fearful of, to look for enemies. Because in our primitive world, that's what kept us safe.
Mm.
So to counter that takes effort. So we're primed for worry talk as well, because it brings people together. There's an other, or there's a worry you share together. So again, even when we're talking to people, we will talk about other people who are bad and how we're good, or we talk about the worries we all have together.
Yeah.
Now, none of that's good for you, because that negative view of yourself and your world and your future can take you down a spiral. And if you're feeling down here anyway, doing that is going to take you further down. To practice gratitude, you just look for three things a day that you're grateful for. Now, this is not, hey, wow, I won the lottery.
Mm.
You know, if you did that, you would be grateful.
Yeah.
This is small, small things. I'm grateful I got to work on time, that the bus was on time. And you have to say why you're grateful for it. Why am I grateful for this? Because I had a meeting at 9 o'clock that I was running, and it meant that everybody wasn't sitting there waiting for me.
Mm.
And I could walk in and say, hi, everybody, I'm here to run your meeting. And wasn't that good?
Mm.
And they all smiled at me, and it was good. So somebody let me in, in the traffic. I had the right change in my handbag for the parking meter.
Mm.
You know, these are small things, but to be grateful for those small things. Now, some people aren't writing people.
Yep.
So it's good to write these things down, because if you're having a really bad day, you can think, ugh, nothing's good in this world. What was good about yesterday? Ah, yes, I was grateful for these three things.
Yep.
Some people might do it on Instagram. Some people might do it on Snapchat. You know, there are different ways that you can do it. You can take photos. You can have a treasure box.
Mm.
You can have a book. But it's to document what those things you're grateful for is really good.
Yeah, I think that's such an important thing, because we so much of the time overlook the little things and ignore them when something, even if it's not a particularly big bad thing that happens, we still ignore the little things, the 20 good things that happen to one bad thing in the day.
Yeah, and we know that that retrains our brain then to look for bad things.
Yeah.
So what we want to do is train our brain to get those new neuronal pathways forming that look for good things.
Right.
Now, this is not Pollyanna. This is not, oh, everything's wonderful. This is real good things.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
So the last thing in the mental health in a nutshell, so it's exercise, social activities of daily living, meaning, mindfulness, distraction, three things to be grateful for. And the last thing is strengths. And I say two strengths. Now, when you start talking about strengths to somebody who's depressed or anxious or got post-traumatic stress disorder, they're not going to see anything.
Mm.
They're going to do the whole worthless and useless and nothing's good in this world thing. So this, at the beginning, is something the doctor carries for the patient.
Mm.
And you have to be honest about it.
Mm.
So you find two strengths of this person, two really strong things that you can say about the person. So it might be, you are such a loyal person. I've listened to your stories, and you worry about your friends so much. You worry about stressing them. You worry about your family. You are such a strong family and friend loyal person.
Hmm.
Now, the person's not going to say, no, I'm not, because they've told you these
stories. They've told you. Yeah, it's fact. Yeah.
Or you might say, you are a person of great courage. You've told me this terrible story about all the awful things that have happened to you, and yet here you are surviving all of this.
Yes.
You have managed to get through it all and sit here and tell me this story. That takes courage.
Mm.
And they say, I don't feel like I've got courage. It's like, courage isn't a feeling. Courage is a choice. If you don't feel afraid, you don't need courage, do you?
Mm.
You only need courage if you are afraid.
Mm.
So
yeah.
You've got courage. And when you say that to a person who's just told you all these terrible stories, what are they going to do? They know it's true.
Yeah.
You've just told them.
Yeah.
I write those down on the piece of paper. Loyal, courage. I say, take this away, because this is what I think of you. And they can go home and think, whoa, the doctor thinks I'm
loyal and courageous. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've got it written on a piece of paper. I've got it in my wallet
mm.
with my picture of my tree. And that's something that they will go back to. So this is the beginnings of a type of therapy called narrative therapy, because as doctors we're trained to look for the bad things so we
yeah.
can challenge them, so we can look for them, so we can, you know, do things with the negative things. But in narrative therapy you listen to that other story, especially someone with mental health problems.
Right.
You look for the other story that's about the positive side of the person. And what you want to do is build that up. You want to build it up in the person. You want to say, so let's think of other ways to use your courage and your loyalty, because I know they're really important, strong things in you. How can we use that? Do you have the courage to go to the shop
mm.
rather
mm.
than buy everything online?
Yeah.
You've done some hard things in your life. Can you do that? And people go, yeah,
I can
go to
the
shop. Heck, I've survived a war. I can go to the shop. It's like, okay. Use that same courage that you use to do that. That loyalty that you have for your family, that loyalty that you don't want to stress them, can you use that to have a conversation that's different from your woe is me conversation?
Mm.
Because that's what that's about.
Mm.
Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah.
So you use their strengths that you've found to take you into places in the rest of the mental health in a nutshell.
Yeah.
In an ideal world, what the patient is then learning to do is to find those strengths for themselves.
Right.
So what I will then say later on is, tell me what your strengths are.
So you're kind of sparking the flame and trying to develop those processes in the patient, that they're
yeah.
starting to look for these positive
mm.
strengths.
Mm.
Mm.
So what I'll do then, I mean, that's taken quite a long time to do the whole thing.
Mm.
But as I said at the beginning, I don't necessarily do all of that
right.
in one consultation. I might.
Yeah.
And it's certainly a way of assessing. But when they come back, and I write all these things down.
Right.
So I'll write all the different headings down and what they're going to do. Walk to letterbox, have coffee, pay one bill,
mm.
buy a plant, you know, water
buy,
a plant.
Buy a plant, buy a tree.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Think about the tree.
Yeah.
Think of three things to be grateful. Remember, I'm courageous and loyal.
Yeah.
So just, you know, you just write them on a little bit of paper, give them to the patient. When they come back, you can assess how they've gone. And then you can look at any barriers to
yeah.
what they said they were going to do. If walking to the corner was too much, let's just do the letterbox.
Yeah.
If a coffee every 2 weeks was too much, let's do it every 3 weeks. So, you know, let's just say hello to someone.
Yeah.
So you do that.
Yeah, working with the patient to try and get them started, yeah.
Yeah, so they've got a management plan, they've got follow-up, and then gradually you can see the person building this up in themselves. And you'll notice them becoming less disabled because they're getting out there, they're doing things.
Mm.
And hopefully their mental health problem is going to start to get better with that as well.
Okay. That's mental health in a nutshell.
That's mental health in a nutshell.
Okay, thanks Jill. I'm sure people listening will be able to implement some of those strategies in their practice. I know I'm going to, so thanks for your time.
Thank you.